Cancer can take away all my physical abilities. It cannot touch my mind, it cannot touch my heart, and it cannot touch my soul. And those three things are going to carry on forever.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Voices for Victory podcast. I'm your host, Mick McDonald, and we're so glad you're back here with us. Each episode of our show, you'll hear stories from people whose lives have been touched by cancer in some way, and what they're doing to move us closer to victory over cancer. Today, we focus on pediatric cancer research. September is Pediatric Cancer Awareness Month, and the V Foundation is committed to supporting breakthrough cancer research that can save more young lives. Cancer is the second leading cause of death in children ages 1 to 14, and can also create lifelong consequences that stem from children receiving cancer treatment. Research brings hope, and the V Foundation wants to give more kids and their families a chance for a brighter tomorrow. In this episode, we'll chat with three people who've had their lives changed by pediatric cancer. First up, we talked to Angela Diltz, whose son Eli was diagnosed with brain cancer at age 7. Then, Scott Vians joins us to talk about his son Nate, who was diagnosed with leukemia just before his 4th birthday. And finally, we'll chat with Makari Tarpley, a teenage actress and Broadway performer who was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma. And now, first up, our conversation with Angela Diltz.
And I always have to think about what's important in life is to think to me of three things: where you started, where you are, and where you're going to be. Those are the three things that I try and do every day.
And we're now lucky to be joined by Angela Diltz. Angela, thank you for joining us today.
Yep, it's my pleasure.
So September is Pediatric Cancer Awareness Month, and your son Eli has had quite a journey that began back when he was 7. How did you first realize that something might be wrong with Eli?
So he started with having headaches, but that wasn't completely unusual for him. He had some allergies and sinus infections that were not atypical for that time of year. But as time went on, the headaches became closer together and much more debilitating. He had some vomiting in the mornings when he woke up. And then one day when I picked him up from school, he mentioned that he had some blackness in the periphery of his vision, and things just seemed to be getting progressively worse, and symptoms were getting closer together. And my spidey senses as a mom started to kind of go off that maybe something bigger was going on than just a sinus infection.
So then what's the next steps there? You took him in to see, to go see a doctor and said, "Hey, look, something's going on here. We need to figure out what's going on."
We did. We took him to his pediatrician, who had been his pediatrician since birth. They looked at him, they treated him for a sinus infection, they put him on antibiotics, and he seemed to get better for a while. And then the headaches came back, but it was tricky because 4 days before his surgery, he was able to get up on a Saturday morning and run a 5K at the YMCA in 28 minutes and had a great morning. And then 4 days later, he found a tumor in his brain.
So yeah, so it's crazy how quickly that came for you guys. You know, when you heard the words, you know, you officially realized that, you know, Eli has cancer. You know, what's the thoughts that are going through your head?
I think initially I physically just shook when we heard the doctor tell us that they had found a tumor in his brain. We went to the local hospital. They did a CAT scan where we were required to stay until they got the results. And we were in the waiting room of the CAT scan area when our pediatrician called and said that they had located a tumor in the back of Eli's brain and that we were immediately to go to Riley Children's Hospital in Indianapolis. And so that night we were checking in through the ER, meeting a neurosurgeon, and it didn't even feel real. Like, it wasn't my life that was happening.
So what were the treatment plans? What were the first steps for Eli that the doctors said, "Hey, here's A, B, and C that we're going to lay out that we think is the right process for him"?
So that night we met with the neurosurgeon and the whole neurosurgical team, and they went in the next morning to remove the tumor. So he was in surgery, I believe, for almost 9 hours to remove the tumor. And then I remember when the doctor came out to meet with us to tell us that he felt that it had went well, but that Eli would need further treatment. And I think then it set in that we were kind of in for the long haul. So after Eli's initial surgery, We were told of all of the potential side effects of the surgery, but there was no other option, right? We had to go through with it. So we didn't realize that we would be facing all of those potential side effects. Eli was actually diagnosed with posterior fossa syndrome, which is a fairly rare complication of his type of brain tumor removal. So when Eli woke up, well, he didn't for a couple of weeks, but he was unable to walk, talk, swallow. He had to relearn to do all of those things. And then in the meantime, they had to treat him immediately. His type of brain tumor, there was a very clear clinical path. And within 28 days of his surgery, he had to start 33 rounds of radiation, which he received proton therapy. And then we went through 6 months of chemotherapy right after radiation was over.
That's just so much for you and your family, let alone for Eli to take on, but for you and your family to take on. You know, when you're going through those tough moments early on, you know, what helped you sort of keep a positive mindset or keep, you know, Eli in a positive mindset once he was going through the chemotherapy? What were some things that helped you?
Well, my family, first and foremost. I'm blessed to have a very large family, and they made it their mission to spend a lot of time with me and with Eli so that I could get a break or have company. I can tell you that the nursing staff at Riley Hospital were amazing. And I was a runner at the time, and every day they would come in the room and say, go get your run in. We will sit with Eli. We will take him out to the nurse's station. And they did. And I would come back, and he would, when he got to that point where he could be out of bed and was a little more mobile, he'd be out at the nurse's station playing a board game with them. They also offered school at Riley. So literally within 2 weeks, the minute he opened his eyes, even before he could talk, they had a teacher in there, and they gave him communication boards, and they never gave up on him. And neither did we. And I think that's just, we just knew we were going to get through it. And so we just plodded forward every day with the help of family and friends and the amazing staff at the hospital.
Was there one moment in his sort of journey or treatment where it was like, it hit you like, hey, he's going to get through this. He's going to do this. Do you remember maybe one moment where you're like, Eli's going to get through this?
I do. And it's going to sound like kind of a crazier moment, because I think for most people, it would have been the moment that they gave up. But I decided to go into his treatment plan one day. All the doctors would have a meeting every morning, and they'd round on the patients. And I had not gone in to listen to it because it was very clinical and very in-depth, and I wasn't in the right mindset. And I walked into that meeting, and it was probably a month in, and they started presenting his case, and they just said, you know, this is Eli Dilts, age 7, stage 4 medulloblastoma. And it dawned on me that my son had stage 4 cancer, and that's usually a death sentence. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, not my kid. He's just not. I just felt it in my gut that he was going to beat it. And I remember his doctor looked at me and said, I can give you the statistics on his survival rate, but I'm not going to, because they don't matter. It only matters what this kid does, what your kid does. And I just held on to that. And I just knew he was going to be one of the kids that beat the odds.
And so how did his treatment wrap up? What's his, you know, future looking forward? You know, kind of where is he in the cancer scope now?
So we finished up at Riley after 6 months of chemotherapy. And then because of he had global ataxia. So that meant he required physical therapy, occupational mm-hmm. therapy, speech therapy. We went to a pediatric therapy center for a month. It was inpatient through Riley Hospital. And then we were discharged to home. And he went back to school after about 3 months of being home. And we went through the course of treatment. You know, it was every 3 months for a while. We had to get an MRI, then every 6, then every year. And actually, we just, every July marks our time for the scan. And we just had our 9-year mark.
Amazing.
And so, yeah. So next year, when we go back, it'll be the last scan, and he will be at the 10-year mark, and he gets to join what's called the Survivors Clinic, which means no more scans, and just, they just follow him as a Riley patient.
Incredible. It's really, it's an amazing story. And you were telling me now that Eli is a runner, took after his mom, right? In that respect. How is he enjoying just kind of life as a normal high school kid?
It's been really great. The school has been wonderful. He does require some extra assistance at school. He has an IEP and he has a one-on-one aide that kind of helps him maneuver around the school and carry his backpack and things. But she's been with him since the fourth grade. And so it's been this wonderful, consistent person in his life. And she's amazing with him. And then his high school started a unified track team his freshman year. An amazing turning point for him because sports were such a huge part of his identity before he got sick. And then that kind of got taken away from him for a while. So to have the opportunity to be a part of a team again was, I think it was life-changing for him and his confidence. And then he had this wonderful built-in support system around him. And just being a part of a peer network and team just was a huge confidence builder for him. And he's very much looking forward to it this spring to get back out there. And in the meantime, he trains with his personal trainer at the Y and just kind of lives his best life.
What a wonderful story that is. We make sure we send all of our best wishes to Eli as he keeps pushing forward. One thing for you, I know this experience for your family is something that unfortunately many other families have gone through something similar or will go through something similar. What advice would you give to someone who is a parent and has a child who's going through a cancer diagnosis?
I think my biggest piece of advice is ask questions, ask a lot of questions, and don't be afraid to challenge the doctors or ask them if there are other ways. Just always be an advocate for your child because you're the only one that's looking out for their best interest and knows them the best. There were a few things that we had to fight for Eli that we weren't on board with. And we always listened to the doctors, but when they listened to us, when they realized that we were going to speak up for our child and be an advocate for them, then we were all on the same page and the same team. And he made more, you know, leaps forward than I think they ever thought he would, and in a much faster pace. So I would just say advocate for your child, always ask questions and stay on top of their medical care because you're the one that knows them best. And it's so difficult when you have so many doctors working on your child. It's, you know, neurology and the cancer doctors, and we had GI doctors involved, and they don't always talk to each other. And so it's really important that you advocate for that and form a whole care team so that they're treating the whole child and you get the best outcome.
And then finally, Angela, how important is it to you that we continue to push forward for more funding of pediatric cancer research?
It's the most important thing we can do. There is no cure for cancer, as we all know, and we need to learn so much more about it specifically in the pediatric realm because our kids are getting some of the oldest, harshest medications because we don't like to do clinical trials on children. And so it's just incredibly important for us to understand how this affects children and get better treatments with less side effects so that we can have more kids beating the odds just like Eli did.
Really well said, Angela. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk to us today. Please send our best to Eli, and hopefully we'll talk to you again down the line.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Next up, we're joined by Scott Vians. Scott, thanks so much for taking the time to sit down and chat with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So, Scott, we're talking about pediatric cancer research this month, and I know that holds a place close to your heart. You know, just before his fourth birthday, your son Nate was diagnosed with leukemia. How did you and your family first learn that something was wrong with Nate?
A lot of the signs were really seemingly ambiguous. And my mom had actually had him for a week while my wife and I were on vacation. And we had noticed a few things with him as far as just being kind of fatigued and lethargic in comparison to the other kids on our block. We were living in Philadelphia at the time. And but nothing really concerning. My mom had him for a week when we were away, and when we picked him up, she said she thought something was wrong. I guess she hadn't seen him in 3 to 4 months, and you know that lapse of time made you know the changes in him stand out a little bit. We actually took him to his pediatric doctor, and I'm assuming she probably had suspicions that he had leukemia because she took blood work. We thought maybe low iron, she got the blood work back that day, and we pretty much gave a call to my wife, and from that point, you know, we rushed him to Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and that kind of began the journey.
So what's, you know, that moment where it sounds like your pediatrician maybe had an inkling or a suspicion, but when you get the blood work back and there's that confirmation that, you know, yes, your child has cancer, you know, what's the first things that are running through your mind?
You know, it's like a lot of serious incidents that you hear people describe. I mean, it really felt like a dream state for over a day. We were in the emergency department of CHOP, and two attending physicians came in. And usually when two attending physicians come in, it's not great news. And they didn't really pull any punches. You know, I was like, well, could it be anything else? You know, is it like this is it? You know, your kid has cancer and they're starting treatment tonight. You know, basically, you're getting admitted to the hospital and this is the journey. You know, it's surreal. You know, it's not something that I think anyone ever thinks is going to happen to their family or their child. You know, you hear that happening in Lifetime movies and in different stories. You know, but it's not something you ever suspect is going to happen to your kid.
So then what was kind of the game plan moving forward for Nate once you guys find out what was wrong?
You know, one of the blessings, like early on, I would say within 24 hours of being inpatient at Children's Hospital, you know, we looked around and there wasn't a lot of why him, why us. It was kind of, you know, there's 50 other families in there. It's kind of why not him, why not us, you know? We weren't alone in this. It was very eye-opening being in the inpatient ward. And luckily, like, we knew immediately, like, we were in the right place. I don't know how to explain that other than, like, the doctors there were just everyone seemed so confident and competent at the same time. And it was one less decision we had to make, you know. The only real decision, you know, from that point forward was how we were going to, you know, walk Nate through, you know, his cancer treatment. You know, we knew we were in the right place.
And it certainly sounds like you had the right attitude. And I think that's important is keeping a positive mindset, not just for you and your family, but specifically for Nate. You know, that initial period when everything's kind of getting going, you know, what was it that helped you kind of keep that positive mindset and you know, really help yourself mentally as you're going through all this?
I mean, I really just thought about Nate, you know, like I said, the only thing we had any control over was how we were going to walk through it. You know, he had cancer, you know, I couldn't change that. We knew we were in one of the best hospitals in the country, you know, for pediatric cancer. That wasn't going to change that situation. And the only thing we had any control over was how we were going to walk through it and try to, you know, stand tall for Nate and you know, do your best. I mean, you know, it was all new to me. I mean, I'm almost embarrassed to say, like, I just hadn't been around, and my wife either. We've been lucky. We hadn't been that touched by cancer, you know, at the time. And it was very eye opening. It's embarrassing to say, I had no idea what that world was like and what families go through and what people go through, you know, in chemotherapy and different types of cancer treatment and all that comes along with it. You know, one person's not, you know, I quit my job at the time. She stayed working. I mean, I had basically became a full-time nurse for the better part of 2 years. You know, it was just kind of all about Nate. You know, I didn't want him to ever be scared, to ever feel sorry for himself, to ever look at himself as sick. I mean, those are hard things to try to balance, you know, when you're going through chemotherapy, you know, at a young age.
So what, you know, Nate's treatment plan and all the chemotherapy he went through, how long did that go on for and kind of how did he, you know, see the light at the end of the tunnel?
The entire chemotherapy was, I think it was 39 months of treatment, 8 to 9 of which was very, very intense chemo, where it was just, you know, we were kind of pre-quarantine and quarantine, for that kind of, you know, like, and I was very neutropenic, extremely low platelets. And essentially, I mean, he almost dies and then you rebound for a week and then you almost die and you rebound for a week. And it's just constant poisoning and medical treatment. And, it's 9 months of that, you know? After that initial treatment, there was, like, I'm assuming about 2.5 years of what they call maintenance treatment. Where you still had, you know, spinal taps and all sorts of, you know, medicines on daily, but, you know, steroid pulses and whatnot, but that was a much more mild in comparison to the initial, you know, 9 month treatment.
And so how is Nate doing now? Can you let us know sort of what he's up to these days how he's kind of put this in his rearview mirror?
Yeah, I mean, Nate's awesome. If you met Nate right now, you'd have no idea that he ever went through what he went through. Right. He actually just set a world record as a 9-year-old for a half marathon.
It's amazing. Yeah. Amazing story.
Yeah, he's a crazy, crazy good runner. And really good skateboarder. We always tried to encourage him even early on while he was in, chemotherapy during the maintenance phase and whatnot, and just try to keep him active. And his doctors were always very encouraging of being active and doing things, and tried not to put a whole lot of limitations on what he did. And, like I said, we never wanted him to see himself as sick, you know? So, when he first was coming out of that initial 9 month treatment, he couldn't get up the stairs by himself. You know, he's 5 years old and couldn't get up the stairs by himself. We just made an effort, you know, after that period of time to start trying to build him up a little bit. You know, he brought his bike with me when I ran and different stuff. And he just, he just took to it.
And now he's setting records.
Amazing. He actually used to ride his little bike with me when I would run. And one day he forgot his bike and he said he wanted to run with me. I think he was 5 years old at the time. And he ran 3 miles with me. And he was totally, he was just strong and I couldn't believe it. And ever since then we started running. And I had no idea, how good of a runner he was in comparison to other kids his age. We just run around a whole lot of other people. We used to go on trips and run mountains and stuff. And one year he decided he wanted to run cross country, and it was the middle of the season. He ran 2 meets that year. He was 8 years old. He ran a regional meet near us and won a mid-Atlantic regional. And then he actually went out to nationals about a month later and won nationals.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, I had no idea, you know?
That is such a cool story to hear how he's come through everything and is, you know, above and beyond what you would expect. Just really awesome, Scott. And I want to ask you too, because, you know, unfortunately there are, and as you said, you weren't aware of this, but when you got into the hospital, you saw how many other families are going through something similar to what you and your family went through with Nate. What advice would you give to another parent who has had a child who's just been diagnosed with cancer?
Two things. The first thing is one of the best bits of advice that we got early on was, if you think you're in the right place for treatment, I really didn't get on the Google rabbit hole or compare my case to everyone else or go looking for a million different answers. Mm-hmm. We really followed, his oncologist's guide and treatment through this and tried not to, I asked as many questions as I needed to of her, but I didn't go a million other places for advice and questions. We kind of stayed in our own little bubble with it, and I think that helps because there's a million good stories, there's a million bad stories, and everybody's case is very different and everybody responds to treatment very differently. And it's just a very unique thing going through chemotherapy. The other thing was we tried not to make, I mean, it's tough and I never fault anyone for it, but we really did our best not to make a big deal out of anything that was happening to him medically. Because there's so much treatment ahead of you, and you see the kids look to the parents, whether they should be scared or not, whether they should be concerned or not. And we had to swallow a lot of emotions and a lot of things, but just try to never, you know, show Nate like, this is just what we're doing, buddy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And try not to project that fear into them, you know. Those are two big things because it's a long treatment, you know. Like if every shot's a big deal, that's tough.
Yeah. I wonder too, now that you've gone through what your family's gone through, how has that sort of changed your views and on how you look at cancer research and the importance of specifically pediatric cancer research?
I mean, it's so huge. I think about it like, I mean, if this would have happened, if Nate's diagnosis would have happened 30, 40 years ago, his prognosis would not have been good. I mean, he was average risk, ALL, B-cell ALL, and, you know, his odds would have been much different in if he did survive, the side effects of treatment would have been much, much different. You know, it's come a long, long ways, you know, because of, you know, all the cancer research that has been done. You know, a lot of these kids are facing decent chances when they get a diagnosis. You know, that being said, there's a lot of kids that we, families we met or people in the hospital that like, look, not all the parents leave with their kids, you know, you know, they don't all leave the hospital bringing their kid home. And that's tough, you know, and you see that in cancer research and the money that goes into this and the groundbreaking science. Like you want everyone who's in that hospital who gets that diagnosis to at least have a little bit of hope of a chance, you know. And we found hope early on, and that was a big thing to hold on to. You know, I don't know what we would have done without, you know, a little bit of hope. And you hope that you know, our wish is that everybody who gets, you know, that call about cancer, that diagnosis, you know, is able to cling on to something medically or, you know, someone else's story or whatever, you know, to find that hope. And that comes through funding and through research.
Yeah, that's really well said, Scott. And that's, you know, as at the V Foundation, that's what we're gunning for, is that, you know, every dollar that goes to research provides someone a little bit more hope when they get that diagnosis. So that's Scott, that's it for today. That's all the time we have, but thank you so much for sharing your story. We want to send our best wishes to Nate as he continues, you know, keep setting records, let him know we're rooting for him, going forward. And just want to thank you again for taking a few minutes to chat with us about your family story today.
Well, thank you guys. I mean, I think I was actually thinking about this earlier that I think the V Foundation is the first charity I ever donated to as an adult, way before I even had Nate, you know. It's impossible not to be moved by Coach V's speech. And when you see that and the humanity of it, you know, it's an honor to be a small part of anything, you know, that he started.
And finally, here's our chat with Makari Tarpley. And we are now joined on the Voices for Victory podcast by Makari Tarpley. Makari, thanks so much for taking some time to chat with us today.
Yes, of course. You're welcome.
So I want to start, you know, you've an incredible life and all the amazing things that you've done as such a young person, you know, in the Lion King, touring, just some incredible things that you've been a part of. But I want to go back to, you know, the beginning of your cancer journey. You know, when did you first realize that something might be a little off or something might be going wrong?
I first noticed when I was, well, I go to a performing arts high school, so there mm-hmm. we take dance classes, vocal classes, a whole plethora of things. So I was taking a dance class, and I noticed that my neck was just, like, really stiff. It wasn't as, like, I couldn't move it as much as I could before, I had noticed before. So I went to my mom, and I was like, hey, Mom, this is weird. Like, why can't I move my neck properly? Maybe I was just paranoid or something. But she was like, well, just wait it out. Maybe you're just sore or something. But then I started to notice, the more I would look at my neck in the mirror, that I couldn't see all those indentions and muscles that you tend to see in people's necks. And I was pretty sure I used to see in my neck. So I was like, okay, I don't think that's normal either. So I told my mom, and she was like, oh yeah, that may be a problem. So we finally up and went to the doctor, and that's just sort of all when it started, when I couldn't move my neck in dance class.
And I think it's, you know, it's an important lesson to learn that you need to pay attention to your body. If it's telling you something, right, you want to make sure you go get it checked out, because while it could be nothing, that wasn't the case for you. So when you went to the doctor, kind of how did that progress to then you finding out, you know, you had been diagnosed with cancer?
Yes, of course. So when I first went to the doctor, they just automatically assumed it was, what are they called? Goiter. They thought it was a goiter. And we have a history of like thyroid issues in my family. So they were like, okay, maybe that gene just passed on to you. Like maybe this is your new normal. And it wasn't that much of an alarm and alert. So they were like, okay, it just may be a goiter. You'll just have to take some medicine to treat it. And so then I went in for an ultrasound because something still didn't sit right with my mom and my family, my dad. So I got some ultrasounds done and they noticed, I believe it was calcification. They noticed a mass in my neck, which they thought was the goiter, but then there was calcification within that. So they were like, whoa, why is there like hard bits and pieces in that? So then led into more ultrasounds because they realized it wasn't just a goiter. So after all these tests and biopsies, they were like, okay, we probably think it's papillary thyroid carcinoma. So that was my first diagnosis, and it wasn't an official one, but they were like, we're like 99.9% sure that that's what that is. Mm-hmm. And it came to when I got a lymph node biopsy to just like certify that, that they realized that it wasn't papillary thyroid carcinoma. So they were like, okay, we need to do some more lab tests, just do more research and really look into this. So after some more tests, more biopsies, they were like, okay, I think we are definitely sure or positive that this is Hodgkin's lymphoma. So,
and I mean, you know, you're a, you know, very successful young person living what, you know, many would say is a dream life so far. And you hear, you know, you have Hodgkin's lymphoma. What's the first thing that flashes through your head when you heard that?
Yeah, it's a scary thought. I feel like everyone gets this thought when they first hear the words, if they do, and it's just, am I going to make it? Am I going to live? Like, is this what's going to take me away from this earth? So it's just that thought like, oh, wow, this is serious. Am I going to make it out of this? So that was my first thought. But I just tried to erase that thought really quick because it's not good to focus on bad things like that. So I was like, okay, I'm going to do it. It's going to be fine.
Well, how did you, so as you go through, you start your treatments, what was it that kind of let you stay positive? What were the things that kind of, you know, you did or went through your mind to keep you in a positive frame of mind as you're going through all this?
Yeah, I would say most definitely like my family, my friends, God. I just kind of stuck to that, really surrounded myself with good people, happy thoughts. My family, they have been there for me every step of the way, always just making sure I'm comfortable, I'm happy, I'm doing okay. And the same thing with my friends. They were always checking up on me, asking me how I'm doing, telling me I'm doing great, and just giving me all these positive words and just being amazing people as they are. And then God, of course, just really tuning into that, that faith and really truly believing that I'm blessed and that I will make it out of this. God's got my back. I mean, so that's what truly kept me in that positive mindset, was family, friends, and God.
And, you know, you've been very public with your journey. You know, you share a lot on social media. Why was it important to you to be open about everything that was going on in your life?
Yeah. So it was a thought initially of like, should we be public with this? Is this like a private matter? And I'm sure it is for many people, but something in me was like, Makari, you need to share this. This needs to be told. And I tend to find myself to be a very open person, so I'm not very good with secrets. So I couldn't really hold on to that because I had close friends that knew, but I also had friends that didn't know, and I wanted to let them know, but I just didn't know if that's what I should do at the moment. So I was like, okay, I just need to come out with this. So it was just a matter of me just wanting to be open. And I think it would be a great story to tell as well, because when I was first diagnosed, my mom and my dad, they were like, hey, Makari, maybe this could turn into your testimony. This could be something you talk to millions of people about one day. So keep that in thought. So that just kind of stuck with me. And then finally, one day it clicked. I was like, all right, I'm going to open up about this. Let's talk.
And I think it's this is a wonderful attitude to have, because I'm sure there, you know, lots of other young people who maybe are looking up to you, they may hear the words, you know, I have cancer, and they say, well, I saw how Makari went through it and I saw how she handled it, and that can be motivation for me as I'm handling it. Did you think about that as maybe being kind of a motivational factor for others who might be going through this?
Yes, of course. And when I was going into about to opening up, I looked into other people's posts. Like I looked up the hashtag Hodgkin's lymphoma and looked up what other people were saying. So seeing how much those people's posts, those strangers' posts, impacted me and inspired me to just like open up and just be okay with what's going on. I really felt like I could be a part of that inspiration as well to other people that needed that help opening up. So I wanted to be a part of that.
It's interesting how it really is sort of a community, right? I mean, you feel a sense of, you know, sameness with other people who've been through what you've been through.
Yes, totally.
So how, I know as you've, you know, gone through your treatments and everything, how important have you learned that cancer research has been to the cancer diagnosis you were given?
Oh, I've learned that it's extremely important. I tend to have this thought, just thinking back, like, what if this happened 15 years ago, 50 years ago, 100 years ago? Like, would I even be alive today? Would it just be an end all be all to even hear those words and not even have that chance to, you know, get chemotherapy? So research has truly brought cancer help and just treatment to an amazing place where people can be cured. That wasn't the case a certain amount of years ago. Like if you heard the word cancer, it basically meant it's over, sorry. But now when you hear those words cancer, there's still a tinge of hope that you could be cured, you can still live, you can make it through this. So through all of this, I've learned that cancer treatment is extraordinarily important and it needs to be continually developed. So it can be as easy as like the flu to get rid of a cold, hopefully in the future. So,
and what if you were talking to someone, or maybe someone's listening to this this podcast? What advice would you give to a young person who has maybe gotten their diagnosis and is unsure, and maybe you know in not a great frame of mind right now emotionally? What advice would you give to them?
Advice I would give to them is just keep your mind in your happy place, you know? So when I was doing a lot of chemotherapy, I would get really in my head during all of it. So my first couple of rounds, it was like, okay, this is kind of all right. I'm not liking it, but I can stand it, you know? But the more I endured it, it was like, okay, I don't like this anymore. I'm hurting. I feel terrible. But it took a matter of me realizing that I needed to distract myself with those happy things. So I would like watch Netflix and things. I would color. I would draw. I would talk to my friends. So advice I would give is just really not necessarily distract yourself, but just keep your mind, your state of mind in that right place. Because if it's not, I don't know how you're going to do it. It's going to be really hard.
Yeah. Embrace some of the regular things in life that maybe you took for granted before, right?
Yeah.
So can you give us an update on how everything's going now, how you're doing, what the future looks like for you in terms of your Hodgkin's lymphoma?
Yes, of course. So on July 1st, I had my last round of chemotherapy. And around the end of July, I had my just scans to make sure everything was looking all right. And it was. So everything is decreasing. Whatever masses there were, they are, if not gone, really little. And yeah, I'm just on a good track. So they said it looked well enough that I wouldn't have to come back for another 3 months. So, and I just got my port out, my portacatheter out 2 weeks ago, Wednesday. So yeah.
Well, wonderful news. We love to hear that. And then because, you know, you're so much more than just, you know, just your cancer. What else is going on in Makari's life? What's next for you?
Well, recently I've been really tied up with virtual school. So I've been doing that. It's different, I would say.
I'm sure.
Yeah. I'm just trying to get through that at the moment. But other than that, I mean, I've still been getting some auditions, so that's fun. I'm not done with that. I'm still keeping it going. And yeah, just living life.
Well, that is awesome to hear, Makari. We certainly wish you continued luck on that. And moving forward, we hope you continue to do big things. And maybe like next year when you've got your next big role, you can come back on and talk to us about it a little bit more.
Yeah, of course.
That's Makari Tarpley. Again, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to chat with us about your journey and all you've been through and the inspiration you are to, I'm sure, so many others.
Thank you. You're welcome.
That's it for today's episode of the Voices for Victory podcast. Thanks again to Angela Diltz, Scott Vians, and Makari Tarpley for taking some time to talk with us today. We're so glad you tuned in. Make sure you're subscribed wherever you listen to podcasts so that you can find our newest episodes as soon as they're posted. And don't forget the nice comments and 5-star reviews, please. You can also find more information about the V Foundation by visiting v.org. And be sure to follow us on all your favorite social media channels at the V Foundation. Until next time.
To me, there are three things we all should do every day. We do this every day of our life. You're going to have, what a wonderful, number one is laugh. You should laugh every day. Number two is think. You should spend some time in thought. And number three is you should have your emotions moved to tears. Could be happiness or joy. But think about it. If you laugh, you think, and you cry, that's a full day. That's a heck of a day.